his head. She steals all the credit others receive. And what is an absolute, if not unique? A woman who truly loves is satisfied to be glorified in one heart. She will not envy her friend's superficial success, but she feels threatened in her very love. The fact is that the theme of the woman betrayed by her best friend is not only a literary cliché. The closer two women are as friends, the more their duality becomes dangerous. The confidant is invited to see through the eyes of the woman in love, to feel with her heart, with her flesh. She is attracted by the lover, fascinated by the man who seduces her friend. She feels protected enough by her loyalty to let her feelings go. She does not like playing an inessential role. Soon she is ready to surrender, to offer herself. Many women prudently avoid their intimate girlfriends as soon as they fall in love. This ambivalence keeps women from relying on their mutual feelings. The shadow of the male always weighs heavily on them. Even when not mentioning him, the verse of St. John Pere supplies, "And the sun is not named, but its presence is among us." Together, women take revenge on him, set traps for him, malign him, insult him, but they wait for him. As long as they stagnate in the gynecium, they bask in contingency, in blandness, in boredom. This limbo has retained some of the warmth of the mother's breast, but it is still limbo. Woman is content to linger there on condition that she will soon be able to emerge from it. She is thus content enough in the dampness of her bathroom, imagining she will later make her entrance into the luminous salon. Women are comrades for each other in captivity. They help each other endure their prison, even prepare their escape. But their liberator will come from the masculine world. For most women, this world keeps its glow after marriage. Only the husband loses his prestige. The wife discovers that his pure manly essence tarnishes. But man still remains the truth of the universe, the supreme authority, the wonderful adventure, master, gaze, prey, pleasure, salvation. He still embodies transcendence. He is the answer to all questions. And the most loyal wife never consents to give him up completely and close herself in a dismal tête-à-tête with a contingent individual. Her childhood left her in absolute need of a guide. When the husband fails to fulfill this role, she turns to another man. Sometimes her father, a brother, an uncle, a relative, or an old friend has kept his former prestige, so she will lean on him. There are two categories of men whose professions destine them to become confidants and mentors: priests and doctors. The first have that great advantage of not having to be paid for these consultations. The confessional renders them defenseless in the face of the babbling of the pious. They avoid sacristy pests and Holy Marys as best they can, but their duty is to lead their flock on the moral path, a most urgent duty, as women gain social and political importance and the church endeavors to make instruments of them. The spiritual guide dictates his political opinions to his penitent and influences her vote, and many husbands are irritated by his interference in their conjugal life. It is he who defines what they do in the privacy of the bedroom as licit or illicit. He is concerned in the education of the children. He advises the woman on her conduct with her husband. She, who always hailed man as a god, kneels with pleasure before the male who is the earthly substitute for God. The doctor is better protected, as he requires payment, and he can close the door to his clients who are too indiscreet. But he is the target of more specific, more stubborn aims. 3/4 of the men harassed by nymphomaniacs are doctors. To undress in front of a man is a great exhibitionistic pleasure for many women. Stekel says, "I know some women who find satisfaction only in an examination by a doctor they like. In particular, there are among spinsters many rich women who see their doctor for a very careful examination because of minor discharges or a banal problem. Others suffer from a cancer phobia or infections from toilets, and these phobias provide them with the pretext to have an examination." He cites two cases among others. A spinster, BV, 43 years old and rich, goes to see a doctor once a month after her period, demanding a very careful examination because she believed that something was wrong. She changes doctors every month and plays the same game each time. The doctor asks her to undress and lie down on the table or couch. She refuses, saying that she is too modest, that she cannot do such a thing, that it is against nature. The doctor forces her or gently persuades her, and she finally undresses, explaining she is a virgin and he should not hurt her. He promises to give her a rectal exam. Her orgasm often comes as soon as the doctor examines her. It is repeated, intensified during the rectal exam. She always uses a false name and pays right away. She admits to having entertained the hope of being raped by a doctor. Mrs. L.M., 38 years old, married, tells me she is completely unfeeling when with her husband. She comes to be analyzed. After two sessions only, she admits to having a lover, but he cannot make her reach orgasm. She could only have one by being examined by a gynecologist. Her father was a gynecologist. Every two or three sessions or so, she had the urge to go to the doctor and have an examination. From time to time, she requested a treatment, and those were the happiest times. The last time, a gynecologist massaged her at length because of a supposed fallen womb. Each massage brought about several orgasms. She explains her passion for these examinations by the first touch that had caused the first orgasm of her life. The woman easily imagines that the man to whom she has exhibited herself is impressed by her physical charm or her soul's beauty, and she thus is persuaded, in pathological cases, that she is loved by a priest or doctor. Even if she is normal, she has the impression that a subtle bond exists between them. She basks in respectful obedience to him. In addition, she sometimes finds in him a source of security that helps her accept her life. There are women, nonetheless, who are not content to prop up their existence with moral authority. They also need romantic exaltation in their lives. If they do not want to cheat on or leave their husbands, they will seek recourse in the same tactic as a girl who fears flesh and blood males. They give themselves over to imaginary passions. Stekel gives several examples of this. A decent married woman of the better social class suffers from nervous anxiety and is predisposed to depressions. One evening during the performance at the opera, she falls in love with the tenor. His singing suffuses her with a strange warmth. She becomes the singer's fanatic admirer. Thenceforth, she does not miss a single performance in which he appears. She obtains his photograph. She dreams of him. And once she sent him an imposing bouquet of roses with the inscription, "From a grateful unknown admirer." She even goes so far as to write him a letter. This letter she also signs, "From an unknown admirer," but she keeps at a distance. An occasion unexpectedly arises, making it possible for her to meet this singer at a social gathering. She decides very promptly that she will not go. She does not care to become personally acquainted with him. She does not require closer contact. She is happy to be able to love so warmly and still remain a faithful wife. I became acquainted with a woman obsessed with the most remarkable Kainz, a famous actor from Vienna. She had a special Kainz room, embellished with numerous portraits of the famous artist. There was a Kainz library in one corner. Here there was to be found everything in the shape of his books, pamphlets, and clippings which she could gather bearing on her hero. She had also gathered in this library a collection of theater programs, including, of course, Kainz festivals and premieres. A particularly precious possession was the portrait of the great artist bearing his autograph. This woman wore mourning for a whole year after the artist's death. She took long journeys to attend lectures on Kainz. This Kainz cult served to preserve the woman's physical chastity. It protected her against all temptation, leaving no room for any other erotic thoughts. Note, Frigidity in Woman. We recall what tears Rudolf Valentino's death brought forth. Married women and young girls alike worship cinema heroes. Women often evoke their images when engaged in solitary pleasures. or they call up such fantasies in conjugal lovemaking. These images also often revive some childhood memory in the figure of a grandfather, a brother, a teacher, and so on. Nevertheless, there are also men of flesh and blood in women's circles, whether she is sexually fulfilled, frigid, or frustrated, except in the rare case of a complete, absolute, and exclusive love, the woman places great value on their approbation. Her husband's too mundane gaze no longer nurtures her image. She needs eyes still full of mystery to discover her as mystery. She needs a sovereign consciousness before her to receive her confidences, to revive the faded photographs, to bring to life that dimple in the corner of her mouth, the fluttering eyelashes that are hers alone. She is only desirable, lovable, if she is desired, loved. While she more or less makes the best of her marriage, she looks to other men mainly to satisfy her vanity. She invites them to share in her cult. She seduces, she pleases, happy to dream about forbidden loves, to think, if I wanted to. She prefers to charm many admirers than to attach herself deeply to any one. More ardent, less shy than a young girl, her coquetry needs males to confirm her in the consciousness of her worth and power. She is often all the bolder as, anchored in her home and having succeeded in conquering one man, she leads him on without great expectations and without great risks. It happens that after a longer or shorter period of fidelity, the woman no longer confines herself to these flirtations or coquetries. Often she decides to deceive her husband out of resentment. Adler maintains that woman's infidelity always stems from revenge. This is going too far. But the fact is that she often yields less to a lover's seduction than to a desire to defy her husband. He is not the only man in the world. I can attract others. I am not his slave. He thinks he is clever, but he can be duped. It may happen that the derided husband retains his primordial importance for the wife, just as the girl will sometimes take a lover to rebel against her mother or protest against her parents, disobey them, affirm herself. So a woman whose very resentment attaches her to her husband seeks a confidant in her lover, an observer who considers her a victim, an accomplice who helps her humiliate her husband. She talks to him endlessly about her husband, under the pretext of subjecting him to his scorn, and if the lover does not play his role well, she moodily turns from him either to go back to her husband or to find another consoler. But very often, it is less resentment than disappointment that drives her into the arms of a lover. She does not find love in marriage. She resigns herself with difficulty to never knowing the sensual pleasures and joys whose expectations charmed her youth. Marriage, by frustrating women's erotic satisfaction, denies them the freedom and individuality of their feelings, drives them to adultery by way of a necessary and ironic dialectic. Montaigne says, "We train them from childhood to the ways of love. Their grace, their dressing up, their knowledge, their language, all their instruction has only this end in view. Their governesses imprint in them nothing else but the idea of love, if only by continually depicting it to them in order to disgust them with it." Thus, it is folly to try to bridle women's desire, which is so burning and natural. And Engels declares, "With monogamous marriage, two constant social types, unknown hitherto, make their appearance on the scene, the wife's attendant lover and the cuckold husband. Together with monogamous marriage and hetairism, adultery became an unavoidable social institution, denounced, severely penalized, but impossible to suppress." Note, Origin of the Family, translation. If conjugal sex has excited the wife's curiosity without satisfying her senses, like in Colette's The Innocent Libertine, she tries to complete her education in the beds of strangers. If she has no singular attachment to her husband, but he has succeeded in awakening her sexuality, she will want to taste the pleasures she has discovered through him with others. Some moralists have been outraged by the preference shown to the lover, And I have pointed out the efforts of bourgeois literature to rehabilitate the figure of the husband. But it is absurd to defend him by showing that often in the eyes of society, that is to say, other men, he is better than his rival. What is important here is what he represents for the wife. So there are two traits that make him detestable. First of all, it is he who assumes the thankless role of initiator, the contradictory demands of the virgin who dreams of being both violated and respected almost surely condemn him to failure. She remains forever frigid in his arms. With her lover, she experiences neither the torment of defloration nor the initial humiliation of modesty overcome. She is spared the trauma of surprise. She knows more or less what to expect. More honest, less vulnerable, less naive than on her wedding night, she does not confuse ideal love and physical hunger, sentiment and sexual excitement. When she takes a lover, it is a lover she wants. This lucidity is an aspect of the freedom of her choice. For here lies the other defect weighing on her husband. He was usually imposed and not chosen. Either she accepted him in resignation, or she was given over to him by her family. In any case, even if she married him for love, she makes him her master by marrying him. Their relations have become a duty, and he often takes on the figure of tyrant. Her choice of lover is doubtless limited by circumstances, but there is an element of freedom in this relationship. To marry is an obligation. To take a lover is a luxury. It is because he has solicited her that the woman yields to him. She is sure, if not of his love, at least of his desire. It is not for the purpose of obeying laws that he acts upon his desire. He also has this advantage, that his seduction and prestige are not tarnished by the frictions of everyday life. He remains removed, an other. Thus, the woman has the impression of getting out of herself in their meetings, of finding new riches. She feels other. This is above all what some women seek in a liaison, to be involved, surprised, rescued from themselves by the other. A rupture leaves them with a desperate, empty feeling. Janet cites several cases of this melancholia that show us bluntly what the woman looks for and finds in her lover. A 39-year-old woman, heartbroken at having been abandoned by a writer with whom she worked for 5 years, writes to Janet, "He had such a rich life and was so tyrannical that all I could do was take care of him, and I could not think of anything else." Another woman, 31, fell ill after breaking with a lover she adored. "I wanted to be an inkwell on his desk to see him, hear him," she writes, and she explains, "Alone, I am bored. My husband brings me no intellectual stimulation. He knows nothing. He teaches me nothing. He does not surprise me. He has nothing but common sense. It crushes me." But by contrast, she writes about her lover, "He is an astonishing man. I never saw in him a moment of confusion, emotion, gaiety, carelessness, always in control, mocking, cold enough to make you die of shame. In addition, an impudence, sang-froid, a sharp mind, a lively intelligence that made my head spin." Note, obsessions and psychasthenia. There are women who savor this feeling of plenitude and joyful excitement only in the first moments of a liaison. If a lover does not give them instant pleasure, and this frequently happens the first time as the partners are intimidated and ill-adapted to each other, they feel resentment and disgust toward him. These Messalinas have multiple affairs and leave one lover after another. But it also happens that a woman, enlightened by the failure of her marriage, is attracted this time by a man who suits her well, and a lasting relation is created between them. Often he will appeal to her because he is of a radically different type from her husband. This is without a doubt the contrast that Sainte-Beuve, who seduced Adele, provides with Victor Hugo. Stekel cites the following case. Mrs. P.H. has been married for the past 8 years to a man who is a member of an athletic club. She visits the gynecologic clinic on account of a slight inflammation of the ovaries. There she complains that her husband gives her no peace. She perceives only pain and does not know the meaning of gratification. The man is rough and violent. Finally, he takes a sweetheart. This does not trouble her in the least. She is happy. She wants a divorce and calls on an attorney. In his office, she meets a clerk who is the exact opposite of her husband. The clerk is humble, delicate, weak, but he is also loving and tender. They become closely acquainted and he begins to court her. He writes her tender letters. His petty attentions flatter and please her. They find that they have similar intellectual interests. With his first kiss, her anesthesia vanishes. This man's relatively weak potentia has roused the keenest orgasm in the woman. After the divorce, they married. Now they live very happily together. He is also able to rouse this woman's orgasm with kisses and other caresses. This was the same woman whose frigidity in the embrace of a highly potent man drove her to take a lover. Not all affairs have fairy tale endings. It happens that just as the young girl dreams of a liberator who will wrest her from under her father's roof, the wife awaits the lover who will save her from the conjugal yoke. An often told story is that of the ardent lover who cools off and flees when his mistress starts talking about marriage. She is often hurt by his reluctance, and from then on, their relations become distorted by resentment and hostility. If a relationship becomes a stable one, it often takes on a familiar conjugal character in the end. All the vices of marriage, boredom, jealousy, prudence, deception, can be found in it. And the woman dreams of another man who will rescue her from this routine. Adultery, furthermore, has very different characteristics according to customs and circumstances. In our civilization of enduring patriarchal traditions, marital infidelity is still more serious for the woman than for the man. Montaigne says, "Iniquitous appraisal of vices, but we create and weigh vices not according to nature, but according to our interest, whereby they assume so many unequal shapes. The severity of our decrees makes women's addiction to this vice more exacerbated and vicious than its nature calls for, and involves it in consequences that are worse than their cause." We have seen the primary reasons for this severity. Women's adultery risks introducing the child of a stranger into a family, dispossessing legitimate heirs. The husband is master, the wife his property. Social changes and the practice of birth control have taken much of the force out of these motives. But the will to keep woman in a state of dependency perpetuates the proscriptions that still surround her. She often interiorizes them. She closes her eyes to the conjugal escapades that her religion, her morality, and her virtue do not permit her to envisage with reciprocity. The control imposed by her social environment, in particular in small towns, in the old as well as the new world, is far more severe for her than for her husband. He goes out more, he travels, and his dalliances are more indulgently tolerated. She risks losing her reputation and her situation as a married woman. The ruses women use to thwart this scrutiny have often been described. I know a small Portuguese town of ancient severity where young women only go out in the company of a mother-in-law or sister-in-law, but the hairdresser rents out rooms above his shop. Between hair being set and combed out, lovers steal a furtive embrace. In large cities, women have far fewer wardens, but the old custom of afternoon dalliances was hardly more conducive to the happy fulfillment of illicit feelings. Furtive and clandestine, adultery does not create human and free relationships. The lies it entails rob conjugal relations of what is left of their dignity. In many circles today, women have partially gained sexual freedom, but it is still a difficult problem for them to reconcile their conjugal life with sexual satisfaction. A marriage generally does not mean physical love. It would seem reasonable to clearly differentiate one from the other. A man can admittedly make an excellent husband and still be inconstant. His sexual caprices do not, in fact, keep him from carrying out the enterprise of a friendly, communal life with his wife. This amity will be all the purer, less ambivalent if it does not represent a shackle. One might allow that it could be the same for the wife, She often wishes to share in her husband's existence, create a home with him for their children, and still experience other embraces. It is the compromises of prudence and hypocrisy that make adultery degrading. A pact of freedom and sincerity would abolish one of the defects of marriages. It must be recognized, however, that today, the irritating formula that inspired Francillon by Dumas Fils, "It is not the same thing for women," retains a certain truth. There is nothing natural about the difference. It is claimed that woman needs sexual activity less than man. Nothing is less sure. Repressed women make shrewish wives, sadistic mothers, fanatical housekeepers, unhappy and dangerous creatures. In any case, even if her desires were more infrequent, there is no reason to consider it superfluous for her to satisfy them. The difference stems from the overall erotic situation of man and woman as defined by tradition and today's society. For woman, the love act is still considered a service woman renders to man, thus giving him the status of master. We have seen that he can always take an inferior woman, but she degrades herself if she gives herself to a male who is not her equal. Her consent, in any case, is of the same nature as a surrender, a fall. A woman often graciously accepts her husband having other women. She is even flattered. Adele Hugo apparently saw her fiery husband take his ardors to other beds without regret. Some women even copy Madame de Pompadour and act as procurers. Note, I am speaking here of marriage. We will see that the attitude of the couple is reversed in a love affair. By contrast, in lovemaking, the woman is changed into object, into prey. It seems to the husband that she is possessed by a foreign mana, that she ceases to belong to him, she is stolen from him. And the fact is that in bed, the woman often feels, wants to be, and consequently is, dominated. The fact also is that because of virile prestige, she tends to approve, to imitate the male who, having possessed her, embodies in her eyes all men. The husband is irritated, not without reason, to hear in his wife's familiar mouth the echo of a stranger's thinking. It seems to him, in a way, that it is he who is possessed, violated. If Madame de Charrière broke with the young Benjamin Constant, who played the feminine role between two virile women, it was because she could not bear to feel him marked by the hated influence of Madame de Stael. As long as the woman acts like a slave, and the reflection of the man to whom she gives herself, she must recognize the fact that her infidelities wrest her from her husband more radically than do his reciprocal infidelities. If she does preserve her integrity, she may nonetheless fear that her husband will be compromised in her lover's consciousness. Even a woman is quick to imagine that in sleeping with a man, if only once, in haste, on a sofa, she has gained a certain superiority over the legitimate spouse. A man who believes he possesses a mistress thinks, with even more reason, that he has trumped her husband. This is why the woman is careful to choose her lover from a lower social class, in Bataille's Tenderness or Cassel's Belle de Nuit. Note, the correct title is Belle du Jour. Translation. She seeks sexual satisfaction from him, but she does not want to give him an advantage over her respected husband. In Man's Fate, Malraux shows us a couple where man and woman make a pact for reciprocal freedom. Yet when May tells Kyo she has slept with a friend, he grieves over the fact that this man thinks he had her. He chooses to respect her independence because he knows very well that one never has anyone. But the complacent ideas held by another man hurt and humiliate him through May. Society confuses the free woman and the loose woman. The lover himself may not recognize the freedom from which he profits. He would rather believe his mistress has yielded, let herself go, that he has conquered her, seduced her. A proud woman might personally come to terms with her partner's vanity, but it would be detestable for her that her esteemed husband should stand such arrogance. For as long as this equality is not universally recognized and concretely realized, it is very difficult for a woman to act as an equal to a man. In any case, Adultery, friendships, and social life are but diversions within married life. They can help its constraints to be endured, but they do not break them. They are only artificial escapes that in no way authentically allow the woman to take her destiny into her own hands. Chapter 8. Prostitutes and Hetairas. Marriage, as we have seen, has an immediate corollary in prostitution. Note, refer to Volume 1, Part 2. Hetairism, says Morgan, follows mankind in civilization as a dark shadow upon the family. Man, out of prudence, destines his wife to chastity, but he does not derive satisfaction from the regime he imposes on her. Montaigne says, "The kings of Persia used to invite their wives to join them at their feasts, but when the wine began to heat them in good earnest and they had to give completely free rein to sensuality, they sent them back to their private rooms so as not to make them participants in their immoderate appetites, and sent for other women in their place, to whom they did not have this obligation of respect." Note, Complete Essays of Montaigne. Translation. Sewers are necessary to guarantee the sanitation of palaces, said the Church Fathers. And Mandeville, in a very popular book, said, "It is obvious that some women must be sacrificed to save others and to prevent an even more abject filth." One of the arguments of American slaveholders and defenders of slavery is that, released from slavish drudgery, Southern whites could establish the most democratic and refined relations with each other. Likewise, the existence of a caste of lost women makes it possible to treat the virtuous woman with the most chivalric respect. The prostitute is a scapegoat. Man unloads his turpitude onto her, and he repudiates her. Whether a legal status puts her under police surveillance or she works clandestinely, she is, in any case, treated as a pariah. From the economic point of view, her situation is symmetrical to the married woman's. Between those who sell themselves through prostitution and those who sell themselves through marriage, the only difference resides in the price and length of the contract, says Morrow. Note, Puberty. A. Morrow, The Psychology of Puberty, British Journal of Psychiatry, 1910, translation. For both, the sexual act is a service. The latter is engaged for life by one man. The former has several clients who pay her per item. One male against all the others protects the former. The latter is defended by all against the exclusive tyranny of each one. In any case, the advantages they derive from giving their bodies are limited by competition. The husband knows he could have had another wife. The accomplishment of his conjugal duties is not a favor. It is the execution of a contract. In prostitution, masculine desire can be satisfied on anybody, as it is specific and not individual. Wives or courtesans do not succeed in exploiting man unless they wield a singular power over him. The main difference between them is that the legitimate woman, oppressed as a married woman, is respected as a human person. This respect begins seriously to bring a halt to oppression. However, the prostitute does not have the rights of a person. She is the sum of all types of feminine slavery at once. It is naive to wonder what motives drive a woman to prostitution. Lombroso's theory that assimilated prostitutes with criminals and that saw them both as degenerates is no longer accepted. It is possible, as the statistics show, that in general, prostitutes have a slightly below average mental level and that some are clearly retarded. Women with fewer mental faculties readily choose jobs that do not demand of them any specialization, but most are normal and some very intelligent. No hereditary fate, no physiological defect weighs on them. In reality, as soon as a profession opens in a world where misery and unemployment are rife, there are people to enter it. As long as there are police and prostitution, there will be policemen and prostitutes, especially because these professions are, on average, more lucrative than many others. It is very hypocritical to be surprised by the supply masculine demand creates. This is a rudimentary and universal economic process. Of all the causes of prostitution, wrote Parent Duchatelet in his study in 1857, none is more active than the lack of work and the misery that is the inevitable consequence of inadequate salaries. Note, A.J.B. Parent Duchatelet, De la prostitution dans la ville de Paris, Prostitution in the City of Paris, Brussels, Société Encyclographique des Sciences Médicales, 1836. Beauvoir's dates are erroneous. The study was republished in 1857. Translation. Right-thinking moralists respond sneeringly that the pitiful accounts of prostitutes are just stories for the naive client. It is true that in many cases a prostitute could earn her living in a different way. That the living she has chosen does not seem the worst to her does not prove she has this vice in her blood. Rather, it condemns a society where this profession is still one that seems the least repellent to many women. One asks, why did she choose it? The question should be, why should she not choose it? It has been noted that, among other things, many girls were once servants. This is what Parent Duchatelet established for all countries, what Lily Brown noted in Germany, and Ricoeur in Belgium. About 50% of prostitutes were first servants. One look at maids' rooms is enough to explain this fact. Exploited, enslaved, treated as an object rather than as a person, the maid or chambermaid cannot look forward to any improvement of her lot. Sometimes she has to submit to the whims of the master of the house. From domestic slavery and sexual subordination to the master, she slides into a slavery that could not be more degrading and that she dreams will be better. In addition, women in domestic service are very often uprooted. It is estimated that 80% of Parisian prostitutes come from the provinces or the countryside. Proximity to one's family and concern for one's reputation are thought to prevent a woman from turning to a generally discredited profession. But if she is lost in a big city, no longer integrated into society, the abstract idea of morality does not provide any obstacle. While the bourgeoisie invests the sexual act, and above all virginity, with daunting taboos, the working class and peasantry treat it with indifference. Numerous studies agree on this point. Many girls let themselves be deflowered by the first comer and then find it natural to give themselves to anyone who comes along. In a study of 100 prostitutes, Dr. Bizarre recorded the following facts. One had been deflowered at 11, two at 12, two at 13, six at 14, seven at 15, 21 at 16, 19 at 17, 17 at 18, six at 19. The others after 21. There were thus 5% who had been raped before puberty. More than half said they gave themselves out of love. The others consented out of ignorance. The first seducer is often young. Usually it is someone from the workshop, an office colleague, a childhood friend. Then come soldiers, foremen, valets, and students. Dr. Bizarre's list also included two lawyers, an architect, a doctor, and a pharmacist. It is rather rare, as legend has it, for the employer himself to play this initiating role, but often it is his son or nephew or one of his friends. Comanges, in his study, also reports on 45 girls from 12 to 17 who were deflowered by strangers whom they never saw again. They had consented with indifference and without experiencing pleasure. Dr. Bizarre recorded the following, more detailed cases, among others. Mademoiselle G. de Bordeaux, leaving the convent at 18, is persuaded, out of curiosity and without thinking of any danger, to follow a stranger from the fair into his caravan, where she is deflowered. Without thinking, a 13-year-old child gives herself to a man she has met in the street, whom she does not know and whom she will never see again. M. tells us explicitly that she was deflowered at 17 by a young man she did not know. She let it happen out of total ignorance. R. deflowered at 17 and a half by a young man she had never seen, whom she had met by chance at the doctor's, where she had gone to get the doctor for her sick sister. He brought her back by car so that she could get home more quickly, but in fact, he left her in the middle of the street after getting what he wanted from her. B, deflowered at 15 and a half, without thinking about what she was doing, in our client's words, by a young man she never saw again. 9 months later, she gave birth to a healthy boy. S, deflowered at 14 by a young man who drew her to his house under the pretext that he wanted her to meet his sister. The young man in reality did not have a sister, but he had syphilis and contaminated the girl. R, deflowered at 18 in an old trench from the front by a married cousin with whom she was visiting the battlefields. He got her pregnant and made her leave her family. C, at 17, deflowered on the beach one summer evening by a young man whom she had just met at the hotel and at 100 meters from their two mothers, who were talking about trifles, contaminated with gonorrhea. L, deflowered at 13 by her uncle, while listening to the radio, at the same time as her aunt, who liked to go to bed early, was sleeping quietly in the next room. Note, Léon Bizarre, Souvenir d'un médecin des prisons de Paris, 1925, Memoirs of a Doctor of Paris Prisons, translation. We can be sure that these girls who gave in passively nevertheless suffered the trauma of defloration. One would like to know what psychological influence this brutal experience had on their future. But girls are not psychoanalyzed. They are inarticulate in describing themselves and take refuge behind clichés. For some, the facility of giving themselves to the first comer can be explained by the existence of prostitution fantasies, about which we have spoken. Out of family resentment, horror of their budding sexuality, the desire to act grown up, some young girls imitate prostitutes. They use harsh makeup, see boys, act flirtatiously and provocatively. They, who are still infantile, asexual, and cold, think they can play with fire with impunity. One day a man takes them at their word, and they slip from dreams to acts. When a door has been broken open, it is then hard to keep it closed, said one 14-year-old prostitute. Note, cited by Morrow, Puberty. However, the girl rarely decides to be a streetwalker immediately following her defloration. In some cases, she remains attached to her first lover and continues to live with him. She takes an honest job. When the lover abandons her, another consoles her. Since she no longer belongs to one man, she decides she can give herself to all. Sometimes it is the lover, the first, the second, who suggests this means of earning money. There are also many girls who are prostituted by their parents. In some families, like the famous American family, the Jukes, all the women are doomed to this job. Among young female vagabonds, there are also many girls abandoned by their families who begin by begging and slip from there to the streets. In 1857, out of 5,000 prostitutes, Parent de Châtelet found that 1,441 were influenced by poverty, 1,425 seduced and abandoned, 1,255 abandoned and left penniless by their parents. Note, Parent de Châtelet's study was written in 1836 and republished in 1857. Contemporary studies suggest approximately the same conclusions. Illness often leads to prostitution, as the woman has become unable to hold down a real job or has lost her place. It destroys her precarious budget. It forces the woman to come up with new resources quickly. So it is with the birth of a child. More than half the women of Saint-Lazare had at least one child, many raised from 3 to 6 children. Dr. Bizarre points out one who brought 14 into the world, of whom 8 were still living when he knew her. Few of them, he says, abandon their children, and sometimes the unwed mother becomes a prostitute in order to feed the child. He cites this case among others. Deflowered in the provinces at 19 by a 60-year-old director while she was still living at home, She had to leave her family, as she was pregnant, and she gave birth to a healthy girl that she brought up well. After nursing, she went to Paris, found a job as a nanny, and began to carouse at the age of 29. She has been a prostitute for 33 years. Weak and exhausted, she is now asking to be hospitalized in Saint-Lazare. It is well known that there is an increase of prostitution in wars and the crises of their aftermath. The author of The Life of a Prostitute, published in part in Les Temps Modernes, tells of her beginnings. Note, she had this story published in secret under the pseudonym Marie-Thérèse. I will refer to her by this name. I got married at 16 to a man 13 years older than I did it to get out of my parents' house. My husband only thought of making me have kids. "Like that, you'll stay at home. You won't go out," he said. He wouldn't let me wear makeup, didn't want to take me to the movies. I had to stand my mother-in-law, who came to the house every day and always took the side of her bastardly son. My first child was a boy, Jacques. 14 months later, I gave birth to another, Pierre. As I was very bored, I took courses in nursing, which I liked a lot. I got to work at a hospital on the outskirts of Paris, working with women. A nurse who was just a girl taught me things I hadn't known about before. Sleeping with my husband was mostly a chore. As for men, I didn't have a fling with anyone for 6 months. Then one day, a real tough guy, a cad but good-looking, came into my own room. He convinced me I could change my life, that I could go with him to Paris, that I wouldn't work anymore. He knew how to fool me. I decided to go off with him. I was really happy for a month. One day he brought along a well-dressed, chic woman, saying, "So here, this one does all right for herself." At the beginning, I didn't go along with it. I even found a job as a nurse in a local hospital to show him that I didn't want to walk the streets. But I couldn't carry on for long. He would say, "You don't love me. When you love a man, you work for him." I cried. At the hospital, I was sad. Finally, I was persuaded to go to the hairdresser's. I began to turn tricks. Julot followed me to see if I was doing well and to be able to warn me if the cops were on to me. Note, Julot is a pet name for a prostitute's pimp. Translation. In some ways, this story is the classic one of the girl doomed to the street by a pimp. This role might also be played by the husband, and sometimes by a woman as well. Elfevre made a study in 1931 of 510 young prostitutes. He found that 284 of them lived alone, 132 with a male friend, and 94 with a female friend with whom they usually had homosexual ties. Note, les jeunes prostituées vagabondes en prison. Young vagabond prostitutes in prison, 1931. He cites extracts of the following letters. Note, in the French text of these passages, there are grammar and spelling errors that we have not reproduced in English. Translation. Suzanne, 17. I gave myself to prostitution, especially with women prostitutes. One of them who kept me for a long time was very jealous, and so I left that street. André, 15 and a half. I left my parents to live with a friend I met at a dance. I understood right away that she wanted to love me like a man. I stayed with her 4 months then. Jeanne, 14. My poor sweet papa's name was X. He died in the hospital from war wounds in 1922. My mother got married again. I was going to school to get my primary school diploma, then having got it, I went to study sewing. Then as I earned very little, the fights with my stepfather began. I had to be placed as a maid at Madame X's on X Street. I was alone with a girl who was probably 25 for about 10 days. I noticed a very big change in her. Then one day, just like a boy, she admitted her great love. I hesitated, then afraid of being let go. I finally gave in. I understood then certain things. I worked, then finding myself without a job, I had to go to the Bois, where I continued with women. I met a very generous lady, and so forth. Quite often, the woman only envisages prostitution as a temporary way of increasing her resources. But the way in which she then finds herself enslaved to it has been described many times. While cases of the white slave trade, where she is dragged into the spiral by violence, false promises, mystifications, and so on, are relatively rare, what happens more often is that she is kept in this career against her will. The capital necessary to get her started is provided by a pimp or a madam who acquires rights over her, who gets most of her profits, and from whom she is not able to free herself. Marie-Thérèse carried on a real fight for several years before succeeding. I finally understood that Julot didn't want anything but my dough, and I thought that far from him, I could save a bit of money. At home, in the beginning, I was shy. I didn't dare go up to clients and tell them, "Come on up." The wife of one of Julot's buddies watched me closely and even counted my tricks. So Julot writes to me that I should give my money every evening to the madam. Like that, nobody will steal it from you. When I wanted to buy a dress, the hotel manager told me that Julot had forbidden her to give my dough. I decided to get out of this trick house as fast as I could. When the boss lady found out I wanted to leave, she didn't give me the tampon before the visit like the other times, and I was stopped and put into the hospital. Note: a tampon to anesthetize the gonorrhea was given to prostitutes before the doctor's visit, so that he only found a woman to be sick if the madam wanted to get rid of her. I had to return to the brothel to earn some money for my trip, but I only stayed in the house for 4 weeks. I worked a few days in Barbès like before, but I was too furious at Julot to stay in Paris. We fought. He beat me. Once he almost threw me out of the window. I made an arrangement with a go-between to go to the provinces. When I realized he knew Julot, I didn't show up at the rendezvous. The agent's two broads met me on Rue Belhomme and gave me a thrashing. The next day I packed my bags and left alone for the Isle of Tea. 3 weeks later I was fed up with the brothel. I wrote to the doctor to mark me as going out when he came for the visit. Julot saw me on Boulevard de Magenta and beat me. My face was scarred after the thrashing on Boulevard de Magenta. I was fed up with Julot, so I signed a contract to go to Germany. Literature has popularized the character of the fancy man. He plays a protective role in the girl's life. He advances her money to buy outfits, then he defends her against the competition of other women and the police. Sometimes he himself is a policeman, and against the clients. They would like to be able to consume without paying. There are those who would readily satisfy their sadism on a woman. In Madrid a few years ago, fascist and gilded youth amused themselves by throwing prostitutes into the river on cold nights. In France, students having fun sometimes brought women into the countryside and abandoned them, entirely naked, at night. In order to get her money and avoid bad treatment, the prostitute needs a man. He also provides her with moral support. "You work less well alone. You don't have your heart in it. You let yourself go," some say. She often feels love for him. She takes on this job or justifies it out of love. In this milieu, man's superiority over woman is enormous. This distance favors love religion, which explains some prostitutes' passionate abnegation. They see in their male's violence the sign of his virility and submit to him even more docilely. They experience jealousy and torment with him, but also the joys of the woman in love. But sometimes they feel only hostility and resentment for him. It is out of fear, because he has a hold over them, that they remain under his thumb, as we just saw in the case of Marie-Thérèse. So sometimes they console themselves with a fling with one of their clients. Marie-Thérèse writes, "All the women have flings, me too, in addition to their Julot. He was a very handsome sailor. Even though he was a good lover, he didn't turn me on, but we felt a lot of friendship for each other. Often he came up with me without making love, just to talk. He told me I should get out of this, that my place wasn't here." They also find consolation with women. Many prostitutes are homosexual. We saw that there was often a homosexual adventure at the beginning of their careers, and that many continued to live with a woman. According to Anna Ruling, about 20% of prostitutes in Germany are homosexual. Fevre points out that in prison, young women prisoners correspond with each other with pornographic and passionate letters that they sign United for Life. These letters are similar to those schoolgirls write to each other, feeding the flames in their hearts. These girls are less aware, shyer. Prisoners carry their feelings to the limit, both in their words and their actions. We can see in the life of Marie-Thérèse, who was launched into lovemaking by a woman, what special role the female pal plays in comparison to the despised male client or the authoritarian pimp. Gillot brought around a girl, a poor drudge who didn't even have a pair of shoes to wear. At the flea market, they buy what she needed, and then she comes to work with me. She was sweet, and in addition, she liked women, so we got along well. She reminded me of everything I learned with the nurse. We had a lot of fun, and instead of working, we went to the movies. I was happy to have her with us. One can see that the girlfriend plays approximately the same role that the best friend plays for the virtuous woman surrounded by women. She is the companion in pleasure. She is the one with whom she has free, gratuitous relations that can thus be chosen. Tired of men, disgusted by them, or wishing for a diversion, the prostitute will often seek relief and pleasure in the arms of another woman. In any case, the complicity I spoke of and that immediately unites women exists more strongly in this case than in any other. Because their relations with half of humanity are commercial, because the whole of society treats them as pariahs, there is great solidarity among prostitutes. They might be rivals, jealous of each other, insult each other, fight with each other, but they have a great need of each other to form a counter-universe in which they regain their human dignity. The friend is the confidant and the privileged witness. She is the one who approves of the dress and hairdo meant to seduce the man, but which are ends in themselves and other women's envious or admiring gazes. As for the prostitute's relations with her clients, opinions vary, and cases undoubtedly vary. It is often emphasized that she reserves kissing on the lips, the expression of real tenderness, for her true love, and she makes no connection between amorous embraces and professional ones. Men's views are dubious because their vanity incites them to let themselves be duped by simulated orgasm. It must be said that the circumstances are very different when it is a question of a mass turnover, often physically exhausting, a quick trick, or regular relations with a familiar client. Marie-Thérèse generally did her job indifferently, but she mentions some nights of delights. She had crushes and says that all her friends did too. A woman might refuse to be paid by a client she liked, and sometimes, if he is in a difficult situation, she offers to help him. In general, however, the woman works cold. Some only feel indifference tinged with scorn for their clientele. Ugh, what saps men are! Women can put anything they want into men's heads, writes Marie-Thérèse. But many feel a disgusted resentment of men. They are sickened, for one thing, by their perversions, either because they go to the brothel to satisfy the perversions they do not dare to admit to their wives or mistresses, or because being at a brothel incites them to invent perversions. Many men demand fantasies from the woman. Marie-Thérèse complained in particular that the French have an insatiable imagination. The sick women treated by Dr. Bizarre confided in him that all men are more or less perverted. One of my female friends spoke at great length at the Beaujon Hospital with a young, very intelligent prostitute who started off as a servant and who lived with a pimp she adored. All men are perverted, she said. Except mine. That's why I love him. If I ever discover he's a pervert, I'll leave him. The first time, the client doesn't always dare. He seems normal, but when he comes back, he begins to want things. You say your husband isn't a pervert? You'll see. They all are. Because of these perversions, she detested them. Another of my female friends, in 1943 in Fresnes, became intimate with a prostitute. She emphasized that 90% of her clients were perverts, and about 50% were self-hating pederasts. Those who showed too much imagination terrified her. A German officer asked her to walk about the room naked with flowers in her arms while he imitated the flight of a bird. In spite of her courtesy and generosity, she ran away every time she caught sight of him. Marie-Thérèse hated fantasy, even though it had a much higher rate than simple coitus, and was often less demanding for the woman. These three women were particularly intelligent and sensitive. They certainly understood that as soon as they were no longer protected by the routine of the job, as soon as man stopped being a client in general and became individualized, they were prey to consciousness, to a capricious freedom. It was no longer just a simple business transaction. Some prostitutes, though, specialize in fantasy because it brings in more money. In their hostility to the client, there is often class resentment. Helena Deutsch speaks at great length about the story of Anna, a pretty blonde prostitute, childlike, generally very gentle, but who had fierce fits of anger against some men. She was from a working-class family. Her father drank, her mother was sickly. This unhappy household gave her such a horrible idea of family life that she rejected all proposals to marry, even though throughout her career she had many opportunities. The young men of the neighborhood debauched her. She liked her job well enough, but when, ill with tuberculosis, she was sent to the hospital, she developed a fierce hatred of doctors. Respectable men were abhorrent to her. She could not stand gentility, her doctor's solicitude. Don't we know better than anyone that these men easily drop their masks of gentility, self-control, and behave like brutes? She said. Other than that, she was mentally perfectly well-balanced. She pretended to have a child that she left with a wet nurse, but otherwise she did not lie. She died of tuberculosis. Another young prostitute, Julia, who gave herself to every boy she met from the age of 15, only liked poor and weak men. She was gentle and nice with them. She considered the others wicked beasts who deserved harsh treatment. She had an obvious complex that manifested an unsatisfied maternal vocation. She had fits as soon as mother, child, or similar-sounding words were uttered. Most prostitutes are morally adapted to their condition. That does not mean they are hereditarily or congenitally immoral, but they rightly feel integrated into a society that demands their services. They know well that the edifying lecture of the policeman who puts them through an inspection is pure verbiage, and the lofty principles their clients pronounce outside the brothel do little to intimidate them. Marie-Thérèse explains to the baker woman with whom she lives in Berlin, "Myself, I like everyone. When it's a question of dough, madam. Yes, because sleeping with a man for free, for nothing, says the same thing about you. That one's a whore. If you get paid, they call you a whore, yes, but a smart one. Because when you ask a man for money, you can be sure that he'll tell you right off, 'Oh, I didn't know you did that kind of work,' or 'Do you have a man?' There you are, paid or not. For me, it's the same thing." "Ah, yes," she answers, "you're right. Because," I tell her, "you're going to stand in line for a half hour to have a ticket for shoes. Myself, for a half hour, I'll turn a trick. I get the shoes without paying. And on the contrary, if I do my thing right, I'm paid as well. So you see, I'm right." It is not their moral and psychological situation that makes prostitutes' existence miserable. It is their material condition that is deplorable for the most part. Exploited by their pimps and hotel keepers, they have no security and three-quarters of them are penniless. After 5 years in the trade, around 75% of them have syphilis, says Dr. Bizar, who has treated thousands. Among others, inexperienced minors are frighteningly susceptible to contamination. Close to 25% must be operated on for complications resulting from gonorrhea. 1 in 20 has tuberculosis. 60% become alcoholics or drug addicts. 40% die before 40. It must be added that in spite of precautions, they do become pregnant from time to time, and they are generally operated on in bad conditions. Common prostitution is a hard job, where the sexually and economically oppressed woman, subjected to the arbitrariness of the police, humiliating medical checkups, the whims of her clients, and the prospect of germs, sickness, and misery, is really reduced to the level of a thing. Note, obviously, it is not through negative and hypocritical measures that this situation can be changed. For prostitution to disappear, two conditions are necessary. A decent job must be guaranteed to all women. Customs must not place any obstacles to free love. Prostitution will be suppressed only by suppressing the needs to which it responds. There are many degrees between the common prostitute and the grand hetaira. The main difference is that the former trades in her pure generality, so that competition keeps her at a miserable level of living, while the latter tries to be recognized in her singularity. If she succeeds, she can aspire to a lofty future. Beauty, charm, and sex appeal are necessary for this, but they are not sufficient. The woman must be considered distinguished. Her value will often be revealed through a man's desire, but she will be launched only when the man declares her price to the eyes of the world. In the last century, it was the townhouse, carriage and pair, and pearls that proved the influence of the cocotte on her protector and that raised her to the rank of demi-mondaine. Her worth was confirmed as long as men continued to ruin themselves for her. Social and economic changes abolished the Blanche d'Antigny types. There is no longer a demi-monde in which a reputation can be established. An ambitious woman has to try to attain fame in other ways. The most recent incarnation of the hetaira is the movie star. Flanked by her husband or serious male friend, rigorously required by Hollywood, she is no less related to Phryne, Imperia, or Cosque d'Or. She delivers woman to the dreams of men who give her fortune and glory in exchange. There has always been a vague connection between prostitution and art, because beauty and sexuality are ambiguously associated with each other. In fact, it is not beauty that arouses desire, but the Platonic theory of love suggests hypocritical justifications for lust. Phryne, baring her breast, offers Areopagus the contemplation of a pure idea.